and it produced the sixth funniest sketch of all time, according to one poll. It is Goodness Gracious Me, the groundbreaking comedy that began life on radio back in the mid-90s. And on Friday night, it returns to BBC Radio 4 Extra with another series of sketches that brilliantly twist British and Asian stereotypes.
I call this meeting of the Delhi Electronics to order. We have a new man starting with us today, a new man joining the team. He's from England. So please be gentle with him. His name is
Jonathan. No, Jonathan.
Jaliana.
No. Jonathan.
Jantawala?
Jammu and Kashmir?
No.
Series 2 of Goodness Gracious Me is back in the Comedy Club this Friday night at 11:30.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
And now Dan Stevens reads The Music Room, William Fiennes' memoir of his magical childhood in a moated castle in which he grew up with his older brother, Richard. Richard has been diagnosed with a severe form of epilepsy. In part two, he experiences dark mood swings, while his brother, 8-year-old William, makes the castle's attic spaces his playground.
Early in December, Dad took me and Richard to find a Christmas tree. Rich had to be coaxed away from the television. He got up with a sigh as if he was doing us a special favour. I was bundled in wool hat, scarf and gloves, two pairs of thick socks on under my gumboots. Rich wore his Leeds bobble hat, his thin leather jacket zipped up. Dad stopped to inspect trees he'd planted, each in a neat square pen of post and rail and wire fencing to keep sheep and cattle off, wire mesh or plastic spiral guards round the trunks to protect against rabbits. He laid his forearms along the top rail and leaned against it, admiring the young tree, a few curling dry leaves still attached. Then the three of us turned to look down at the house and the gatehouse, outlines honed to rimy sharpness in the cold. The moat had started to freeze. Ducks congregated in open patches. A heron rose from the frost-white bank below us and flew over the Saw Brook.
"There he goes," Rich said, his surly TV mood forgotten.
Once in the wood, we started looking for a Norway spruce among beech, cherry, holly, elder and hawthorn.
"I think this is the one," Dad said. "Don't you, Rich?"
Richard considered it solemnly, frowning beneath the Leeds hat, looking round to rule out other spruces before offering his agreement. Dad always let Rich fell the tree. Even as Rich took the bow saw in his right hand, he grew and strengthened with responsibility. He bent and got in close to the trunk and punched the saw forward.
"That's it, Rich," Dad said. "Let the saw do the work."
But Rich didn't hear him. He seemed to be pitting his own strength against the trees. When the saw got stuck, he didn't reverse the stroke gently and start again. He applied brute force and wrangled it from the groove. I touched the blade and drew my hand back quickly from the heat. Whenever Rich was fully engaged in some physical task, his tongue dropped in front of his bottom teeth and pushed out his cheek below the corner of his mouth. Now, his tongue already probing his cheek in concentration, he leaned into the branches, fitted the blade, and wrestled the saw back and forth until there was only an inch of trunk intact. We heard the first splinter cracks as the tree teetered.
"All right, Rich," Dad said. "Stand back."
Richard watched with a lumberjack's brawny pride as the spruce fell in a rush of needles. I had the junior task of stripping brash from the trunk with a folding pruning saw. Dad and Rich heaved the spruce onto their shoulders and walked it down the park back to the house. I didn't question the world as I found it. Our wide moat and gatehouse tower, the medieval chapel above the kitchen, the huge, uninhabited rooms to the west, and the parade of strangers that passed through them each year. The way our house was divided into two parts, one private, the the other open to public view. I didn't question my brother's seizures or the frightening and unpredictable swings of his mood. These two were just facts I grew up among. How things were. I went to boarding school when I was 8. I didn't mind. I liked the gregarious, crowded days. At home, I didn't have neighbours I could call on or friends further down the street. I had a castle to explore whenever I wanted, but I was still afraid of the other end. I had to dare myself to leave our familiar quarters and walk alone through those cold historical spaces beyond the music room. The latch click echoed in the vaults when I opened the door into the groined passage. I had a goal, a destination. I ran up the east stairs to a landing off the long gallery and stopped at the foot of a narrow winding staircase. The stairs led right up into the roof, into attic spaces known as the barracks since the 17th century, because soldiers had slept here during the Civil War. The air smelled of stone, wood, dust, damp cotton and paper. Grey light seeped through the skylights, almost opaque with cobwebs and guano. I opened drawers and lifted dust sheets, finding junk sale arrays of bowls, jugs and candlesticks, rigid leather gauntlets, riding boots hardened round wooden boot trees, and a shin-high herd of carved elephants. Victorian wage books, photograph albums, and bundles of postcards and letters strewn with bat droppings. Some objects drew me back again and again. A cherry wood cabinet had 4 slim drawers, divided into square compartments, each home to 2 or 3 birds' eggs in nests of white tissue paper and cotton wool. In a black metal case among chairs draped in dust sheets, I found a naval hat, the real thing, black felt trimmed with gold braid, a downy white plume arching off the crest. I put it on and drew a sabre to lunge and parry down the passageway, cutlass sound effects in the gloom. I stopped in front of the secret door. It was invisible, no giveaway handle or outline in the half-dark. This disguise, and the fact that it was always shut, gave the door and what was behind it a threshold power. I thought the door was closed not to keep people out, but to keep something in. I was afraid of it. Now I stood in front of it, breathing quickly. "Hello?" I said. I put my ear to the door. "Hello?" Richard had started to smoke a pipe, but hadn't mastered the technique. When we watched TV together, the room filled with smoke. I peered through drifts to make out the picture. Soon, the pipe's repertoire of new sounds, the rap-rap-rap of the chamber on the earthenware dish, the lid flip and rasp of the angle flame lighter, the scratch of the cleaning tool, the blasts he blew through the stem to clear the airway, cheeks puffing like a trumpeter's, included a distinctive cough, a smoker's cough that made me worry for the state of his lungs. But nobody considered taking his pipe away. More than pleasure, it was a form of autonomy, free from institutional interference, with its own private codes and rituals, its own dexterities to master and demonstrate. He liked to smoke in the drawing room. In the evening, Mum sat at one end of the sofa next to her sewing table. Rich had made a cotton reel holder in a woodwork class which had pride of place. Dad sat opposite, rereading favourite books in his mother's small everyman editions. Trollope, Tolstoy, Stendhal, George Eliot and Henry James. The mantel clock ticking. The sound of small metal trinkets shifting in compartments as Mum opened the drawer beside her. The fire rustling and crackling, like someone walking in a wood. Mum and Dad encouraged him to read. He had a pile of Tintins on his bedside table, dog-eared hardcover editions with torn bindings, loose pages filed in haphazard order. His concentration didn't have stamina for other books, but he loved words. Puns, coinages, and other verbal games were sources of delight, inexhaustible. Mum, especially, was his accomplice in such things. A word would give them pause, and together they'd tease out the pun in it. She was standing at the kitchen sink. Rich walked to her across the green linoleum, paused close behind, and placed his right hand on her left shoulder. "Mum," he says, leaning close to her ear. "Mum." He doesn't need to say that to get her attention. The Bible weight of his hand has already announced him.
"Shall I tell you something, Mum?"
"Yes?"
"You were saying about the car. I was just thinking of something."
"What was it?" She turned to face him.
"The day is starting the ignition of life," he said, smiling.
Richard could swing from gentle benevolence to aggression and back again within a few hours, as if a different personality had taken him over and then given ground. The lesions in his frontal lobes were interfering with his capacity to think ahead or imagine himself into other people's shoes. Often the whole character of the day hung on the result at Elland Road. We became lead supporters by proxy. If the team lost, Richard sank into despair, an inarticulate rage he carried from room to room, a thundercloud expression on his face, all the springs and coils wound tighter in him. He sat through meals in silence. He helped himself to enormous heaped portions, as much as the plate could hold, then dropped the plate onto the mat as if testing for cracks, food spilling off the heap onto the table. Then he leaned back on the chair, making the joints wince, using his knees under the table ledge to prevent him tipping.
"I'm not sure that's very good for the chair, Rich," Dad said.
"Who asked for your opinion?"
The chair winced again as he spread his shoulders and stretched away from the table.
"Was the heron there this morning?"
my mother asked. But Richard was set on his course and wouldn't be diverted.
"You should keep your mouth shut," he said,
still fixed on Dad's intervention. He looked straight ahead or down at his food.
"Don't speak until you're spoken to."
The room's fibres stiffened. The threat of violence sharpened the air. Something mean deep inside me savoured the tension.
"Remember what we said about behaviour?" my mother said. "You keep out of it."
"That's enough, Rich," Dad said.
"Shut your mouth!"
He turned to face my father.
He raised his fork to Dad's neck. "Keep your mouth shut or there'll be trouble," he said.
He held the fork at Dad's Adam's apple, his whole body clenched. Dad leaned away, looking down at the table. Rich stretched out his arm, keeping the fork prongs poked into Dad's neck. I didn't move. Rich lowered the fork and turned back to his plate. Dad got up and carried his plate and glass to the sink. The water in the moat warmed up through July. My mother and sister were usually the first to brave it. Even after weeks of high summer, the heat never penetrated more than a couple of feet, which meant a thin quilt of warm water over icy depths, and a premium on swimming as flat as you could, keeping to that upper warmth. To swim a whole moat circuit was to move among moorhens, coots and mallards, dragonflies and damselflies, lily pads sitting on the water like jam papers, a heron standing up to its ankles in the shallows. I dreamed of sailing on the moat. Mum folded a dust sheet in half on the diagonal and rigged this triangular mainsail to a window pole. We launched the green boat together, and I sat in the stern, holding the sail's loose corner, while Mum sat amidships, clamping the mast between her knees. The boat drifted. The sail flapped disconsolately while I paddled us through the drag of a lily patch. I picked up my corner again and pulled the sail tight against the mast. We both saw it fill with wind. Not just saw, but felt it too. A tug in the hands, the sheet's creases vanishing into a taut, smooth curve. I held onto the sheet corner with both hands. Mum held tight to the mast, and we began to move, powered by wind. But then the sheet pulled free from its knot at the mast top, and we slowed again. Mum gathered it up and secured it once more to the end of the window pole. But it was too late. The wind had dwindled. We just had the memory of that brief, euphoric surge. A few seconds in which we got what we wanted from the elements by intelligent collaboration.
the swollen tension of our sail, water slapping beneath us like applause.
Dan Stevens was reading part two of The Music Room by William Fiennes, abridged by Viv Beebe and produced by Elizabeth Allard. And tomorrow, Richard is captivated by a heron, while William and his friends play with antique swords and cannonballs.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Time for a little drama now at 3 o'clock, I think. Well, more Victorian melodrama, actually, complete with dastardly villains and a ghostly woman in white who flits in and out of Wilkie Collins's story. Marion Holcombe takes up the story of her sister Laura and Sir Percival Glyde next. And then it's goggles at the ready as Mel finds out how lasers work and takes us on a trip to South America. That's in today's 4 o'clock show. So now it's back to our story by Wilkie Collins. Walter Hartwright has discovered that the mysterious woman in white he encountered one night on Hampstead Heath is somehow connected with the house in Cumberland, where he's been taken on as drawing master to Laura and her half-sister Marion. Walter has fallen in love with Laura, but she's promised to Sir Percival Glyde. As Walter leaves Limeridge, he finds himself feeling decidedly uneasy about the forthcoming marriage. And he's not the only one.
I confess it. I did not, till the last few days, realise the strength of my sister's feelings for Walter Hartwright. I had no suspicion that the love Laura felt for him had taken root so deeply and threatens to alter her for life. Now, having discovered my error, I find that I have lost all faith in my judgment. Can it be right for Laura to marry Sir Percival Glyde when she loves another? And if she does marry Sir Percival, is he a man to be trusted? One thing, however, I am sure of. Dearest Laura is deeply, pitifully unhappy.
The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins. Dramatised for radio in four parts by Martin Wade. With Juliet Aubrey as Marion Halcombe, Emily Bruni as Laura Fairley, Toby Stevens as Walter Hartwright, Philip Voss as Count Fosco, Jeremy Clyde as Sir Percival, and Edward Petherbridge as Mr. Fairley. Episode 2.
Marion, I can bear this no longer.
My dear sister.
I must finish with it, and I will.
You mean you will break off the engagement?
No, no, I can never do that. But I will end this secrecy. I will tell Sir Percival the truth, that I love another.
What? You'll make a confession?
Yes. And then, if he wishes, he may release me from my promise.
But Laura...
Dearest sister, he has a right to know. If Sir Percival is to grant my release, he must do so because he knows the truth.
The 9th of November. It was arranged that Laura should talk with Sir Percival this morning, and that I should be present too. Laura's courage in this business has astonished me. We have, it seems, changed places. She has been the determined one. I have been all hesitation.
Sir Percival, Marion has told me of your offer. She has told me that if I expressed the wish to break off the engagement, you would grant it. That was generous of you, very generous. However, if it is to be broken off, then the wish must be entirely yours, not mine.
Miss Fairley, I promise you, there is no reason why I would want to end the engagement.
Oh, but there is. Sir Percival, when our engagement began, I was unable to feel any strong affection towards you, but affection was still mine to give to you if I could. There was no other man, I mean, to whom I felt an emotional attachment. You must forgive me, however, when I inform you that this is no longer the case.
Sir Percival? But my sister has been more than frank with you. Have you nothing to offer her in reply?
I can only repeat, Miss Halcombe, what I've said already. If your sister wishes to break off the engagement, she's free to do so.
Sir Percival, let me also tell you that if I do not marry you, I will not marry another. The person who has gained my affection, I have not spoken to him of my feelings, nor am I ever likely to meet him again. I have said all that I wanted to say, more than enough, I think, to give you justification in withdrawing from the engagement.
No, Miss Fairley, quite the opposite. You have said more than enough to make it my dearest wish to marry you.
I see.
Sir Percival, please, I urge you...
Forgive me, Miss Halcombe. If your sister had asked for the engagement to be broken, well, I would have submitted. But she has left the decision to me. And since my love and admiration for her are greater than ever, I find myself averse to wrecking my own happiness. I'll not relinquish Miss...